Until the late 1960s, Detroit was a booming industrial center with a thriving auto industry, well-paid manufacturing jobs, an enviable location on the Great Lakes, and it was much admired for its city planning. But today, the city suffers from economic depression, urban decay, and a high crime rate that includes a thriving illegal drug trade. Luke Bergman, the research director of the Detroit Department of Health and Wellness Promotion, tells of the city's downward spiral through the stories of two young drug dealers in a new book called Getting Ghost, Two Young Lives and the Struggle for the Soul of an American City. It's published by the New Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Luke Bergman to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You write, "When I set out to begin research on this book, I didn't think that I would spend so much time talking and thinking about drug dealing." Why did drug dealing become such a major focus of the book?
Well, I started research for this book by working in the juvenile detention facility in downtown Detroit, Michigan.
And were you already teaching at the University of Michigan?
Actually, at the time, I was a PhD student, just beginning a PhD in the program in anthropology and social work at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And what I was really aiming to do was tell, a story about Detroit that would reveal what it means to be a young person in that city, and hopefully sort of tell the story of the city, some about the city's history through the experiences of young people there. And after not too long at all, it became quite obvious that the most meaningful, kind of penetrating way to tell that story would be to do it through the petty street drug trade and young people's involvement in it.
And you wind up telling the stories of two teenage drug dealers named, I'm sure you've made up these names, Dude Freeman.
That's right.
And Rodney Phelps.
Yeah, those are pseudonyms.
And you met them at the juvenile detention facility?
That's right. That's where I initially ran into them.
Why them in particular?
Well, that's a good question.
I'm sure there were a lot of interesting kids there.
Yeah, well, some of it, as with so much that sort of unfolds in this book, it was a kind of combination of intent and accident. Rodney I met after I had been spending time at the juvenile detention facility for only a couple of days, and I was actually invited into a classroom. There's a small charter school within that locked facility, and I was invited into a classroom sort of on the spur of the moment and asked, while wearing a pair of green Dockers and an orange dress shirt, to explain to the kids there something about hip-hop culture. I was invited to do that after the instructor of the class learned that I was a cultural anthropologist. And after,
I would think they would have known a lot about the hip-hop culture.
Of course, right. Yeah. No, I mean, I think I failed miserably in an effort to describe to this group of people anything about hip-hop culture. But whatever I said was engaging enough to Rodney at the time, who was sitting in that class, that he approached me afterwards and said, "Whatever it is that you're doing in here, I want to work with you." And he just turned out to be an extremely bright, charismatic young person. And in the conversation that took place in that classroom, actually, he, sort of demonstrated to everybody there that he was articulate and thoughtful. And so I thought, well, he would be, obviously a really good person for me to work with. I think his motivations for working with me, for kind of engaging me in a research project that he at that point knew very little about, are complex. And he, in fact, later, many years later, told me that one of the reasons he approached me was because he thought, here is a white guy with, who's working on a PhD, clearly seems bright and somehow connected. Maybe at some point he can help me come up in the dope game.
Not get out of the dope game.
That's right. He saw me as a potential ally and or sort of advisor in the dope game.
Did you feel that the kids you met in juvenile detention were kind of destined for a life of crime and violence?
No, not at all, actually. It doesn't feel, when you talk to them, as if there's anything kind of providential or inevitable about the lives that they're leading. And they, they have in some cases, realistic and often pretty expansive dreams about where their lives might lead. A lot of them have aspirations of becoming professional people.
And they're just going to make some money to get themselves to a point where they can approach,
that's
try
right.
to deal with that?
Yeah, that's right. For young people in the dope game in Detroit, the idea is that dealing drugs is something that young people can do. You know, it's something that the labor market there will allow young people to do, and it's something that they hope to get out of as soon as possible because they understand that illegal money simply isn't worth as much as legal money.
Does the juvenile detention system make much of an attempt at rehabilitation?
You know, in some cases it does. There are some facilities that do pretty intensive work with young people. But it's I wouldn't say especially effective.
Where does the title Getting Ghost come from?
Getting ghost is actually a phrase that I would hear pretty often on the streets when I was doing field work. After spending a lot of time in the juvenile detention facility, I moved into one of the neighborhoods where young people with whom I was interacting there lived. Actually, I moved into Rodney's neighborhood on the west side of the city. And spent a lot of time, you know, around and in drug markets in Detroit, just street drug markets. And people on a very mundane level would say that they had to get ghost simply when they needed to leave, when they needed to, you know, run an errand or get from one place to another place. And I felt that it was, you know, an especially sort of evocative and poetic phrase for a couple of reasons. One is that most of these young kids with whom I was spending time and about whom I'm writing had very acute senses for their own mortality, for the likelihood that they would not live very long lives. And so the idea of ghosts is, you know, captures something about that.
Well, Rodney's mother was trying to press the importance of the Bible on him.
That's right.
Was he responsive at all?
Well, for him, he was certainly sensitive to her imploring of him to read the Bible and to become more invested in Jesus, but he thought about religion and he thought about sort of his commitments to Christianity in a very sophisticated, very complex way, and in a way very much informed, actually, by the criminal justice system. A lot of young people who are locked up think about their obligations to Christianity as or in a way analogous to how they think about their obligations to the criminal justice system.
Now, you moved into his neighborhood, which is called the D.C. neighborhood.
That's right.
Why D.C.?
Well,
and what was the neighborhood like?
Well, his neighborhood is on the west side of Detroit, and he called it D.C. because at its center was the intersection of Dexter Avenue and a street that I call Carrington. That's actually a pseudonym for another street. That neighborhood for him was defined initially very much by the drug markets situated within it. At the corner of D.C. was a liquor store on one side of the street, a gas station on the other side of the street, and a whole lot of abandoned property surrounding that corner. And it was, in some ways, a corner very typical of a lot of commercial thoroughfares in Detroit. Lots of abandoned spaces, very few open businesses. The open businesses that are there tend to be, you know, of only a few sorts: liquor stores, gas stations, or Greasy Spoon Coney Island restaurants. And almost all of those retail spaces become, at some point or another, important drug markets in the city.
My guest is Luke Bergman, a research director at the Detroit Department of Health and Wellness Promotion and a faculty associate of the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. His book, Getting Ghost, Two Young Lives and the Struggle for the Soul of an American City, the city being Detroit. And as you said, Rodney was on the west side. The other person you write about, Dude, was from the east side. Isn't there a firm east-west divide in Detroit?
Yeah, there's a really pronounced and interesting divide between the east and west sides of the city, marked by Woodward Avenue, which runs from the Detroit River on the south side of the city all the way up into the northern suburbs. And, you know, it's a divide between east and west that that is importantly geographic, but also has real important cultural dimensions. People who grow up on the west side of Detroit, even though the west side of Detroit is in a lot of ways just as, you know, kind of impoverished and crime-ridden and difficult as the east side, people on the west side don't venture onto the east side and vice versa.
Is that because there were competing gangs in each of the areas?
Actually, no. It's not something that...
So these kids are not members of a gang?
No. Involvement in the dope game in Detroit is generally talked about as an alternative to involvement in sort of gang culture. And it's generally understood that young people who get involved in gangs do it at a younger age than people who are in the dope game. And people who are selling drugs think of gang involvement as sort of trifling, as, you know, as a kind of silly waste of time.
Because they're capitalists. They're entrepreneurs.
Right, exactly. I mean, fighting over colors, fighting over representing, you know, simply doesn't make a lot of sense.
How old was Dude when you met him?
Dude was 16 when I met him.
And how old was Rodney?
Rodney was 17.
What was Dude like? What was he in juvenile detention for?
When I first met him, Dude was in detention for being caught with a gun, with a handgun on the street in his neighborhood.
So it wasn't drugs that got him arrested?
No, and it's, you know, very often the case that that people are who are involved in the drug trade are arrested for things not having to do immediately with drugs. Usually it's for, you know, for some activity or behavior that has to do with drug dealing. But these kids are smart enough to protect themselves usually for a direct drug charge.
Did Dude get into dealing drugs because he was a user?
No. In fact, almost none of the young African-American kids with whom I was spending time in Detroit were using the drugs that they were selling, except for weed. There's a lot of weed smoking among young people, of course. But, you know, crack and heroin, which are the primary sort of drugs on the market and drugs that these young people are pushing on the streets, are so stigmatized in the city that the newest generation of street dealers, you know, wouldn't dream of using them.
Well, in Rodney's case, his mother was trying to convince him to find religion as a way out. But in Dude's case, wasn't drug dealing the family business?
In some ways, yeah. I mean, his family was deeply, deeply and in really complicated ways involved in the drug trade. His mother had been selling prescription drugs. She was actually on dialysis 3 times a week and so had really good access to prescription medication that she could then sell or have one of her kids sell for
her. Out of their homes. Is that important? Because they weren't on the street corners, the sort of thing that we've seen in television in Baltimore, for example.
Right, yeah. How would we have heard of that, I wonder? Yeah, that's right. And that's, you know, I structure the book in some ways so that I tell the stories of, you know, a West Sider in Rodney, and I tell stories around an East Sider in Dude. And I also use kind of that structure in the book to talk about different kinds of drug markets in different places. So in telling stories about drug markets on the West Side, I focus on street markets and on markets that take shape around retail spaces. I write a lot about a Greasy Spoon Coney Island restaurant on the West Side that was taken over by young people on Dexter Avenue and in fact turned from a dining area into a booming heroin spot. And then on the East Side, I focus primarily on the sort of evolution of drug trades in people's houses and the importance of the creation of these places that are both retail markets and domestic intimate places.
Dude recounts numerous times when his house was raided by the police. Do you think that it would have been possible for him to avoid the drug trade given the circumstances he was living in at home, let alone in the city of Detroit?
It would have been extremely difficult. I mean, as I describe, his, you know, members of his family were, you know, being given crack to sell on street corners when they were, you know, 9, 10 years old. He had twin siblings, both of whom were given drugs to sell on street corners by Dude's adoptive father, and he sort of followed the same path.
Although Dude lives with Ruby, somebody who is trying to get him out of this. Is she... when he gets out of juvenile detention, she tells him not to go past a certain street. She tries to get him to go to a basketball camp and to a gun awareness class, but she really doesn't have any control over him.
No, she doesn't have the resources that it would be necessary to have in order to curtail his drug dealing activity. I mean, she implores him not to get involved in ways that he ends up getting involved. She implores him not to go into certain neighborhoods. But at the same time, she can't sort of wrap her arms around him to the extent that would be necessary.
When you were hanging out with Rodney, you met a whole cast of characters, not just drug dealers, including some who may have been responsible for murders. How scary is this?
how scary was it for me?
Yeah, and what about for something like Rodney? He could have been shot any time.
Yeah, well, he was extremely stressed out a great deal of the time. And as is maybe not surprising, there aren't a lot of, you know, kind of public venues for young people living on, you know, on Detroit's streets to talk about how stressed out they were. And he and I did develop a sort of wonderful rapport eventually that allowed him to talk about that.
Did either of these kids go to school?
Yeah, they both were in high school at some point. Rodney was kicked out. There has been a zero-tolerance policy in the Detroit public school system that makes it very easy for that system to kick people out and so that they can't re-enter even a different school.
So they're really just encouraging these kids to engage in the drug trade. I mean, what are the kids going to do if they're thrown out of school at 15 or 16?
Right. Well, it's certainly not explicit encouragement, but the Detroit public school system is a deeply, deeply problematic institution. It's about $400 million in debt. The facilities are crumbling. There's been such incredible depopulation in the city that over the last few years, almost 100 schools have closed. There are 25 more on the chopping block for between the end of this year and the beginning of the next.
And many people say that it was the riots in July 1967 that started Detroit's decline. That was over 40 years ago. Do you believe that the riots should be blamed for what we see today?
Actually, no, I don't. And there's been some really wonderful scholarship suggesting that thinking needs to be changed. In particular, a person named Thomas Sugrue wrote a book called Origins of the Urban Crisis that does a wonderful job of describing how, you know, Detroit's depopulation and sort of beginnings of its decline began actually in the 1950s. I mean, Detroit was booming through World War II and into the 1950s. But the riots are a really important milestone, I think, and extremely important in people's memories.
But didn't they also speed up white flight?
They did to some extent, but actually there had been already, you know, white flight was already in full swing when the riots happened in 1967.
But despite the fact that the city is predominantly black, you point out that there are very few African-American-owned businesses in Detroit.
Yeah, there are almost no small retail businesses that are owned by African-Americans.
No attempts made to change that? Because in other places, seed money is provided, and we see the development of a lot of black businesses.
Yeah, actually, there was not too long ago an effort to create what was going to be called African-American Town in Detroit. And it would be, as proposed, adjacent to an enclave of ethnically identified businesses in the downtown area called Greektown. But it created such a sort of firestorm of racial hostility and demagoguery that those plans were put on hold.
A listener in Chicago would like to know if you have any thoughts about the effect of the long tenure of Coleman Young as mayor of Detroit. And I guess I would add to that the current situation where the most recently elected mayor is now in jail.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, recently released, Kwame Kilpatrick was recently released and virtually immediately given employment at a subsidiary of CompuWare and is an account manager there, making almost over $300,000 a year. So I think a lot of folks in the city find that problematic. A lot of people talk about Coleman Young as the kind of instigator of Detroit's problems because the divide between city and suburb in the Detroit metropolitan area is so pronounced. And he, you know, he did do some things to contribute to that, certainly.
But could politicians have stemmed the tide?
I think they could have done more than they did, certainly. But I would hesitate to blame all of that on Coleman Young. There was a sort of perfect storm during Coleman Young's tenure because while he was in power, L. Brooks Patterson, who is a very outspoken county executive of a suburban region, was also contributing, I think, really significantly to the importance of, you know, this kind of racial hostility between city and suburb that still pertains to this day. I mean, you know, the racial demagoguery that still happens among city council people in Detroit and the sort of adversarial sense that pertains between city and suburb is amazing.
Another problem is that attempts to revitalize the city like the Renaissance Center were financed by the auto companies. They don't have any money to finance anything right now. My guest has been Luke Bergman. his book, Getting Ghost, Two Young Lives and the Struggle for the Soul of an American City. It's published by the New Press. And Mr. Bergman will be giving a talk tonight at 7 o'clock at the Blue Stockings Bookstore at 172 Allen Street between Stanton and Rivington on the Lower East Side. Thank you so much for coming by to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me.